Hi, welcome to Starting Cycles, the podcast where we adapt the science of positive psychology for the context of motherhood to help you start cycles of generational well-being in your family. My name is Catherine, I am your host, and Starting Cycles is my offering to the world. One of the biggest struggles I hear from mothers is that they have read a lot on child development and they know what to do for their child, but they can't seem to actually do it. And one of the biggest places this shows up is in emotional regulation. I hear the following over and over again. I know I need to keep calm when my child is having a meltdown, but I just can't seem to do it. So the issue here is parental emotional regulation. And what I've found is that because we are asking about regulation in the context of being a parent, we look to the child development literature for answers. And the literature gives us a lot of advice about how to keep calm in the moment. You might have read that you should take a deep breath or put your child down safely and go to another room to collect yourself, but it does not reliably work. Why? Because having emotional regulation doesn't happen spontaneously in the moment. Emotional regulation depends on what you do outside of the moment. Let me give you an analogy. Think of the advice from the child development literature as what you should do when you're in a basketball game. Breathe, aim, shoot. And they're not wrong. In the game of parenthood, that's exactly what you need to do to score points for your child. But do you think you could just go onto a basketball court, breathe, aim, and then score out of the blue? Of course not. A player scores on the court because of all they do outside of the game, and most of that does not even involve shooting hoops. And so as parents, we are expecting to perform in the moment when we haven't done any of the practice or conditioning to support that outcome. So, what are the precursors to performing on demand when it comes to emotional regulation? Well, the literature on child development doesn't give you that because it has nothing to do with your child or developmental psychology. It has to do with you knowing about how emotional regulation works in general, and all that information comes from the realm of positive psychology. So in this episode, I'm going to teach you about emotional regulation. I will draw upon the latest science, integrating research from the work of Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett, Dr. Mona De La Hook, and Dr. Nassim Taleb. I will explain how emotions are made, where they come from, what their purpose is, what causes them to happen, and I will then tie that into the child development literature, explaining comprehensively all that the latest science tells us in relation to how we actually regulate emotionally in the moment your child needs you to the most. So with that, let's dive in. To start off, we need to clear up some very prevalent misconceptions that people have about emotions and how they work. People think that emotions are hardwired into the brain at birth, and that emotions conduct themselves in a very reactive kind of way. This is based on the idea that there is this animalistic part of the brain that we are constantly trying to tame. In fact, an oppositional relationship has been created between the rational and the emotional, and when the rational side of your brain wins, you're a moral, healthy, together person. And when the emotional side wins, you're seen as this out-of-control person. And so we have this idea that emotions, at least negative ones, need to be restrained, that they are this prehistoric leftover part of ourselves that we are trying to rise out of. And it can certainly feel like negative emotions happen to you and cause you to do and say things that you might later regret. But that's actually not what happens at all. So what does happen? Let's start at the beginning. The first thing to understand is that our most important job as human beings is not to be whole, content, or happy. It's to survive and propagate our genes. So your brain's main job is to keep you alive. The way it does this is by maintaining a pool of resources, energy essentially, that it can draw upon each day to keep you alive, irrespective of what you may face. In order to keep track of your body's resources in relation to the outside world, your brain runs a budget. Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett has used the term body budget. Just as a company has a finance department that tracks deposits and withdrawals and moves money between accounts, so its overall budget stays in balance, your brain does the same thing for your body. The deposits your body needs are simple: sleep, nutritious food, and exercise. These are the only energetic inputs we have. It seems so simplistic, and it's advice we have all heard before a million times, but not necessarily with the explanatory substance that helps us to really understand why it's so important. Sleep, nutritious food, and exercise are our base income. That is what we have to spend on life. And the more we optimize our sleep, eating habits, and exercising habits, the more we have to spend. Everything else we do is that spending. They are the withdrawals, and it's a lot. Firstly, it's all the automatic functioning happening within your body. Your organs, breathing, digesting, immunity, along with everything else you do externally. Working, learning, spending time with friends, just living in the world, and the big one, stress. All kinds of stress. While withdrawals generally spend your energy quite efficiently, stress drains your budget in an unequal relationship to the deposits. So there is constant movement here, incomings, outgoings, and your brain needs to keep track of how well it's doing body budget-wise. And so your brain is constantly sending messages to all the different parts of your body to survey the available resources. And your body is always sending sensory information back to your brain in response, like how much glucose, how much oxygen, how much salt, and so on and so forth, that you have available. Now, when we look around to the external world, we see lots of detail and sharp edges. But internally, in the world inside us, we don't feel every internal sensation in detail that comes from every movement of every artery, nerve, every muscle. We can't feel our liver working, for example. And that's good because it would overwhelm us and we wouldn't be able to pay attention to anything else. Your brain isn't wired in a way that you experience internal sensations in a lot of detail. So when your brain is sending messages down to your body to see how you're doing budget-wise, a highly summarized representation of all the sensations from all your internal organs and tissues, the hormones in your blood, and your immune system get sent back up in this abbreviated, condensed synopsis that is transmitted through a generalized feeling. And the emotions that we feel originate out of those feelings. So your body automatically runs its internal systems outside of your awareness. It fuels your life silently, and then sends a condensed summary of how well it's doing resource-wise through the mechanism of an emotion. And the emotion is a signal that we need to take action with respect to our body budget. Now, we don't get clear information as to what exact action, if any, needs to take place. We get a range of different types of emotions that hint at what we might need. Now, this is a highly simplified version of the research, but let's review what different emotions mean about our body budget. Positive emotions that feel good are our body's way of telling us that our budget is in good condition given the environment that we're in. Negative emotions that feel bad are our body's way of telling us that our budget needs attention, given the environment that we are in. And this is a radically new way of thinking about nervous system activation. You see, our negative emotion is not our body simply reacting to something in our environment. In fact, it is our body's way of communicating to us how our body budget is faring based on what is happening in said environment. So this is the missing piece to how emotions were viewed before. Emotions don't just rely on what's happening around you. That's only one part of the equation. If you're flush with resources, negative events that you experience won't feel as difficult. I'm not saying you'll be super happy when something bad is happening. Your body will still go towards the negative to warn you that you're in a state of high spending, for example. But the feelings won't be as drastic if you're high up in the black, not nearing the point of a deficit. And if we think about it, it makes sense. Why is it that some days nothing can really set me off? I'm happy, nothing bothers me. Traffic, nope. Mess, nope. It might be a little annoying, but it doesn't set me off. In the context of what we now know, my budget is flush with resources. No matter what happens in my environment, I feel okay because I'm playing in the black. But after a bad night's sleep, everything is a problem. Or if I haven't eaten well, the mess makes me angry, the traffic makes me anxious. But just the day before, it was fine. So it's not about the traffic or the mess. It's about me and my resources on a given day. Now, when our body budget runs low, either from too much stress, poor nutrition, lack of sleep, or other factors, it can lead to the experience of negative emotions. These negative emotions, such as anxiety or sadness, are essentially the brain's way of signaling that we are heading towards the red, towards deficit, in our internal environment, and it needs to be addressed. It's very intuitive. Think simply when you're tired, you're in a bad mood. That is the theory of constructed emotion in its simplest form. It's important to drive home this point. Everything we experience in the world gets filtered through the state of our body. If our budget is low, the alarm will be sounded through feeling negative, and our whole experience will be affected by this. We won't just feel a negative emotion, but can have negative perceptions and evaluations of us, our lives, and the world around us. But it's got nothing to do with our lives in the world per se. We feel negatively only because our body has calculated that we are low on resources in relation to what we are experiencing. And had our body budget been in a better state, we would feel differently. So negative emotions are not necessarily diagnostic about something in the world around you. They're simply an indication that you are running low on resources based on what you're facing. And so more resources, sleep, eating well, and exercise, can change how we feel, without the external environment changing at all. So having our body budget in good condition can place a positive hue over our experience irrespective of what it is. So the most basic thing you can do for your well-being is to take care of your body with sleep, eating well, and exercise. Even though those things can be hard to do, it's the quickest shortcut to feeling good. And people who exercise know this. If you revisit my interview with Nikki, that's episode 2, she says that exercise and exercise alone is what turned things around for her after she had her second child. And knowing what we now know, this makes perfect sense. So separate from what you experience, a lot of which is out of your control, by sleeping well, eating well, and exercising, you can put yourself in a position to feel well irrespective of what may happen. So we have a lot more control than we think. And it may not sound glamorous or profound, and it's a radically different view to the prevalent rhetoric, but the base foundation of emotional regulation is appealing to our core inner need to survive. And central to that need is having the resources available to handle what is happening in our environments. So with this understanding, let's tie this into our issue of how to keep calm when our kids are having a meltdown. It can be helpful to think of the state of our body budget in terms of zones. There are three broad zones that form a continuum along which our nervous system oscillates. Picture a scale from 1 to 10. 1 is flush with resources and 10 is deficit. We start in the green zone. This would be around 1 to 4. It takes us from calm to just where we're starting to get a bit agitated. Next comes the red zone, about 5 to 7, where we are now gradually getting upset. We have a lot of anger and energy in our body. You can think of this as the fight or flight area. When we get into the red zone, we have this automatic need to thrash out, run away, hit something, slam something, shout. It's actually our body's way of trying to metabolize that surge of energy that we experience. So just note, when you feel yourself getting into the red zone, it can help to move your body like a quick mini exercise to digest that energy and help it regulate once again, i.e. move back into the green zone. Now, when we are unable to regulate from the red zone, we could move further up the scale into the blue zone, around 8 to 10. Here, your body shuts down. It freezes. Just like a circuit will short or trip if it gets too hot to protect the system, our body does the same thing. As I said, we produce this surge of energy when we get into the red zone to deal with the stressor. But if it's not dealt with, the body doesn't want to expend further energy, as that would be detrimental to the body budget. It wants to conserve its resources, so it shuts down. It cuts spending temporarily. So you freeze. This is your freeze response. Now, you might seem calm on the outside, but actually you're frozen, you're disconnected. So we can see this in ourselves when we are quiet but aren't interacting with our environment. And on this theme of exerting some energy but also wanting to conserve at the same time, exercise is obviously spending energy, but in an excellent way. In our financial budget analogy, it's like making a low-risk, high-return investment. But part of your body still resists because it has this natural drive to protect its resources. Just an interesting anecdote. So we have the green zone, the red zone, and the blue zone that tell us how we are doing budget-wise. So a tantrum is a stressful event for us as parents. Seeing our child in tears is a very expensive experience for us. It draws down on our resources. And our reaction in that moment will depend on what resources we have available to us, as evidenced by where we are on the green, red, blue continuum at that time. Are we in the green? If so, we can stay calm for a period of time. We have resources available. If we are in the red, we will probably lose it because our bodies are warning us through our emotions that it is low on resources, that it doesn't have enough stores to deal with the hugely stressful event it's experiencing right now. So again, this is why one day your child won't get to sleep on time and it doesn't matter to you. Your body has calculated that it has the resources to deal with this. You have energy. You can be patient and you can wait for your child to eventually sleep. Another day might be completely different. Your child won't sleep and you're about to lose it. You just want them to go to bed because you are exhausted and your body is warning you through these negative feelings about to burst out that it is heading towards a budget deficit. So crucial to staying calm when your child is having a tantrum is being in the green zone, which you do through maintaining a healthy body budget. And the key to maintaining a healthy body budget is not getting to the point where you are overdrawn or close to being overdrawn. So the purpose of this research is not to teach you to wait until you yourself are freaking out and realize that, oh, I'm in the red, I need to make some deposits. It's to help you build up the sensitivity to realize when resources are on the way down, you're running low, and teach you how to take action to stop yourself from getting into a state of depletion, because that is when we lose it. So by tuning into our body and simply taking a second to acknowledge how we are feeling in the context of this continuum throughout the day, we can then make some decisions based on what we have available to give at that particular moment. When we feel that we are low on resources, until we can make some deposits, our job is to create environments to the extent that we can that aren't expensive. We try to find low spending contexts. And our body sometimes naturally helps us to do this. For example, you've had a hectic week, you're tired, you don't feel like going out. That's your body telling you we've spent a lot this week. Let's stay home and conserve some energy until we can replenish our reserves. And to add to that, the general feeling of feeling tired, of being sleepy, is your body telling you that you need sleep. But often we ignore this tiredness and we drink a cup of coffee or something like that. And we need to become more receptive to what our body is telling us through those feelings of sleepiness or tiredness. So often I feel the pressure to set up an interesting, stimulating activity for Ollie, for example, that I know will result in a lot of mess. And even when I'm tired, I do it because of said pressure. But then I just end up getting angry at the mess. But after learning what I've just explained to you, I've become really strict at not planning to do what I don't have the emotional capacity for. Knowing that the most important thing for him is for me to be in the green zone, calm, connected, and present, safe, reliable, and loving. Parenting in general is an expensive endeavor in terms of emotional expenditure. This insight into finding low spending contexts is vital as we navigate our way towards keeping a balanced body budget. And when we're nearing a deficit, finding low demand situations becomes essential until we're able to make some deposits into our emotional reserves. However, even with ample resources, parenting still is a very expensive context. It is imperative then to take steps to make our parenting environment more efficient. In the context of the theory of constructed emotion, our job as parents is not only to manage our own body budgets, but to manage those of our children as well, until they get older and can do it for themselves, and with these insights as to how it actually works. We have heard over and over out of attachment theory how our kids are born completely reliant on us for all their needs. And this is true of their body budgeting needs too. We feed them, manage their routine, give them the opportunity to be active, and manage their environments. So we play a big part in handling their inputs and outputs. And their behaviors are a representation of their accumulating stress load as it relates to those inputs and outputs. And this point warrants repeating. A dysregulated child is not trying to misbehave. A tantrum is simply an outward manifestation of their nervous system sounding the alarm that their resources are low. So Dr. Mona De La Hook says, it's not that toddlers deliberately throw tantrums. It's that tantrums throw toddlers. Tantrums signal a budgetary deficit. And as it's us managing their inputs and outputs, we have so much more control than we think over their behavior once we understand how emotions are made. So we can help our kids have fewer emotional outbursts by monitoring where they are on the green, red, blue continuum and taking action to prevent them from becoming depleted. And their behavior when they are depleted is the biggest drawdown on our budget. And so there is this symbiotic relationship where us managing our body budgets is good for us and good for our kids. And us managing our kids' body budgets is good for them and good for us. And this might be another way to think about co-regulation. So when it comes to managing our toddler's body budget, it's important to note that in toddlerhood, we see huge progress in terms of communication that we often forget that they are still at a very tender developmental stage. We often fall victim to what is called the expectation gap, where we expect more than what our child can handle developmentally. And it's nuanced because toddlers seem fine until they're not. So we really need to become attuned to how their body budget is faring in relation to the inputs and outputs we are managing for them. Just like we should not plan to do what we don't have the emotional capacity for, we should not push our toddlers to do what they don't have the emotional capacity for, and importantly, keeping this expectation gap in mind, because we tend to overestimate what we think they can handle. And I'm not saying that we need to shield our kids from all stress. This is not about coddling. This is not a situation of preparing the road for our kids, but of using the research to prepare our kids, really prepare them for the road. We want our kids to be resilient. Even more, we want them to be anti-fragile. The concept of anti-fragility was introduced by Nassim Taleb. Anti-fragility is essentially next-level resilience. Typical resilience is when you put pressure on a system, after that pressure is lifted, that system goes back to its original form. Anti-fragility takes this idea a step further. You put pressure on a system and after, it actually grows stronger. A wine glass is fragile. If you knock it over, it breaks, nothing good happens. A plastic cup is resilient. You knock it over, it doesn't break, but nothing good happens. But our muscular system is anti-fragile. We go to the gym and we lift weights, we're putting pressure on our muscles. What happens as a result is that we actually grow stronger. Our immune system is another one. If you protect kids from bacteria, if you keep them in a sterile environment, you're damaging their immune system. The immune system has to face challenges in order to grow and learn. But we don't go so far as to expose them to a dangerous disease, so it's titrated. Growing as a result of pressure and stress is known on a psychological level as PTG, post-traumatic growth, which you might have heard of. So we want our kids to have the skill to grow stronger from the stress they do experience. You see, each of us has their comfort zone, and to step outside of it can feel a little uncomfortable. But how do we increase it? We push ourselves a little bit, and then our comfort zone gets bigger. And to increase it again, we push ourselves a little bit more, and again, our zone of tolerance expands. So what has emerged from the research is that there is good stress, stress that grows our kids' comfort zones, builds their resilience, and supports their overall well-being, and bad stress that is bad for their brains, their development, and their long-term ability to flourish. This is like the immune-strengthening bacteria versus the dangerous disease in our immune system example. So there is a very fine line that we parents need to hold between a good challenge and pushing our kids too far. But being able to get our kids into the perfect zone between healthy discomfort and it being too much is really important, because in that twilight zone is where the growth as a result of pressure happens. Dr. Mona Delahook in her book Brain Body Parenting calls this the challenge zone. So some stress is good. How do we tell the difference between the good stress and the bad stress? How can we tell when pushing our kids will be a good thing and when pushing them will be a bad thing? Well, when our kids are in the green zone, we push them. They are on a firm footing, their body budget is balanced, they have some resources available to spend on taking on a little stress. they are in a good place to grow. They are receptive to a challenge and likely to grow from a little pressure. But when they are heading towards the red zone, they are already activated, already stressed out. Subjecting their system to additional stress will only leave them worse off. We grow their anti-fragility by stretching them little by little, not by exposing them to too much too soon. So what we have explained here is that we need to manage our kids' inputs and outputs so that they don't get chronically depleted. But we don't do this by shielding them from all stress. We do this by managing a fine balance where we push our kids just enough to get into their challenge zone, but not too far that they get depleted. And that actually by doing this, we are building their capacity to handle more and more stress over time. So what does it look like in real life when we see our kids are getting to the limit of what they can handle on a particular day? Well, unless it's right before their bedtime when they can be replenished, we need to change our plans to suit their available resources until we can replete them with sleep, for example. Just like we did with ourselves, we find low spending contexts. This would be things like predictable routines, low stimulation, but most importantly, present and attuned time with us. Because as we said earlier, our kids are so reliant on us to care for them. So it makes sense that their default low spending context is with us. When a child is low on resources, there may be a tantrum. And one might say, oh, don't worry, they're just doing it for attention. Yes, they are. And it is healthy for them to seek out close contact with their parents in moments of depletion, because when they're close to someone they love and are being cared for, their spending is minimal. That tantrum is their nervous system doing exactly what it's supposed to do, seeking out a low spending context. And this might be a way to view some forms of separation anxiety. By now, we understand the importance of managing the inputs and outputs of our children to prevent chronic depletion and the associated expensive meltdowns. So let's look a bit more at this specifically in the context of toddlerhood, when we are most challenged to keep calm when our kids are often dysregulated. Toddlers in particular go through a huge developmental leap that is extremely expensive in terms of stress, which often leaves them close to depletion and can leave us short of options. And integrating the science of emotions from positive psychology with our understanding of what toddlers are going through developmentally has really helped me get a new perspective on this phase and adjust my expectations. We know that the first 3 months of our babies being born are really restrictive. We understand that that time requires a lot of sacrifice, and we lose ourselves. And when our kids get a bit older, there's this little bit of space for us. They can handle a bit more. Maybe we are finding our new identity a little. But in bringing this research together, and if we are willing to accept that toddlerhood doesn't need to be just meltdown after meltdown, and are wanting to apply the research to improve the emotional landscape at this time, we now see that in toddlerhood, we are still really limited if we want to keep our body budgets balanced. In this unavoidably expensive phase, there are still a lot of sacrifices to be made, and we might need to adjust our expectations in light of the research that I've shared. Pushing our kids when they are depleted is hard because they have meltdowns. And supporting them when they are depleted is hard because it's really limiting and restrictive to us. But it's this idea of both options are hard. So choose your hard to the benefit of building this resilience and this anti-fragility, to the benefit of starting cycles of generational well-being in your family. And so, back to the issue of how to maintain calm when your toddler is having a meltdown. Well, hopefully this is self-evident by now. We manage our kids' body budgets preemptively to prevent meltdowns, and we manage our own budgets to ensure we have the resources available for those times when a meltdown is unavoidable. Monitoring where we are on the green, red, blue continuum is our way of tapping into how our budget is faring based on the environment that we are in. And we manage our own budgets to ensure that we have the resources available for those times when a meltdown is unavoidable. And surrendering to the fact that parenting is hard and it's not our season to be out all the time living life as we did before. It's our season and our responsibility to budget wisely. And to do so will serve the ability of our kids to handle hard things in the future. Because in applying the science, we can start to imagine a world where we and our children navigate life with a balanced budget, see life through a positive lens, with this broad wingspan of resilience in which to hold a wide range of difficult experiences that we will inevitably face, and where our responses to what we come up against are shaped by a deep understanding of how our body works in relation to our environment. This is the promise of starting cycles of well-being, where daily actions, although not easy, are informed by research and compound over the course of your life, creating a legacy of wholeness. And this idea of our actions compounding, of benefits accruing over time, is so important. These deposits we are making into our budgets, into our kids' budgets, can feel hard in the moment. They can feel prohibitive, but they are not just for today. They create psychological capital that both you and your child will be able to draw on for the rest of your lives. And knowing this really helps to motivate me to keep making decisions that will cultivate and nurture cycles of well-being. One intentional, sometimes difficult, but ultimately rewarding action at a time. The purpose of this episode was to answer the question, I know my job as a parent when my toddler is having a meltdown is to stay calm and help them re-regulate, but I can't seem to do this. Why? We have explained what is happening in your body in those moments when you can't stay calm and have offered a lot of knowledge as to how you can give yourself the best opportunity to stay regulated, as well as how to create an environment where your child is less likely to have meltdowns. We have given a very brief introduction to the science to give you some insight into what the research offers us, namely that an emotion is your brain's creation of what your bodily sensations mean in terms of body budgeting in relation to what's going on around you in the world, and that the emotions that come from inside our body are our body's way of protecting us and helping us to stay healthy and balanced. In the official Starting Cycles program, we go into much, much more detail. Here we focused on one side of the equation, optimizing the inputs, sleep, eating well, and exercise. We touched on the idea of creating low spending contexts when our budget is low. In the program, we expand on the idea of spending efficiently in great detail. We talk about how our brain is always telling a story of what is happening around us that dictates how much stress we perceive in any given situation, and how that the perception of stress is subjective and unique to each person based on what they learned growing up, and thereby introducing the idea of cultivating a low spending narrative in both your and your child's lives. We talk about teaching low-spending emotional concepts to our kids and ourselves. For example, anxiety as stomach in knots versus anxiety as butterflies in my stomach ready to fly in formation. And that we can recast sensations of the nervous system into signs that the body is doing its job to help you prepare to accomplish something, and how this is a more efficient perception that can help us to stay balanced. So a lot of interesting stuff there. If you want to learn more, please go to startingcycles.com. This was a complex one, but a really important one. If there's anything in this episode you want to ask me about, please reach out via the Starting Cycles website or on Instagram at startingcycles_themovement. And if we don't talk, see you in the next episode.